Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good news, bad news, crazy news, as usual for conservatives. And we start with the good martini, although it's a little bit mixed for me, Jim. I'm curious to get your reaction to it. And that's the Republican look back at 2012, what went wrong, why we didn't do better at the presidential level and other levels for that matter. And some of the things that Reince Priebus and others at the RNC have come up with, I think are really good. Limiting the debate schedule, number one. There were way too many of those. They want to change the fundraising rules a little bit, or at least priorities, and I think that would be good. They also want to get far, far away from the 47% mentality and not just talk to ourselves, as Priebus puts it, but actually have a conversation with groups that right now are not voting with us, which runs the gamut from Hispanics to blacks to unmarried women to gays and so forth. But it's interesting how they call for a comprehensive approach to immigration without getting real specific. I hope what the Republicans are saying here on some of these issues is that they're going to do a better job of empathizing with people who may disagree with them and actually have a conversation with them. I hope they follow the Jindal Rubio line and don't think they need to change principles in order to get votes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to like in this plan, even if you don't like every line of it. Obviously, they spent a couple of months talking to hundreds of folks across the country about this, about how mostly this is about how the Republican National Committee can do its job better. And while I think the RNC's performance in 2012 was better than the one in 2010, people are going to look at this and say, well, how can you say that? We had a great year in the 2010 midterms. Yes, but the RNC was not very well managed under Steele, large amounts of money being wasted. He left the committee deeply in debt. Campaigns that we just were, you know, knew in the 2010 midterms just not to count on the RNC. I think it was a much smoother ship under Reince Priebus last cycle. But clearly, look, you know, you lose the presidential election, you don't make any headway in the Senate. There's going to be a sense that the party, you know, infrastructure needs to get better. And I think that's the single biggest difference between what the Republicans are doing, what the Obama team is doing. Basically, Inauguration Day 2009, the Obama campaign never really went dormant, and it went into directly into the tech research and online research and reaching out to different demographics and how can they maximize their vote? How can they maximize their vote against newly legalized, you know, new U.S. citizens? How can they maximize their vote among people who are turning 18? Just looking for every possible vote and advantage that they could get. And a lot of stuff that the, you know, the Republicans just weren't doing because the McCain campaign disbanded after the 2008 election. And the Romney campaign is trying to form in about a two-year window. And so basically the RNC is the only natural spot for a permanent infrastructure and apparatus for going out and doing these sorts of things and bringing people into the Republican Party 24/7, 365 days a week, 366 in a leap year. So this is something that really needs to be done, whether or not you agree with every little recommendation that came out of this report. I think something like that comment about a comprehensive immigration reform, yeah, it's going to be a red flag for a lot of people. Some people are also interpreting some of the comments about young people rolling their eyes at the party as a call for gay marriage and things like that. None of these things are that explicit. This is not really – the RNC's purpose is not to set policy for the party. That comes from the candidates. That comes from the office holders. That basically comes from who gets elected by all the grassroots. But in terms of just making sure that you get you speak to people, I think the single greatest statistics I saw explaining 2012 came from the fact that you look at advertising on Spanish language radio and television. It was 9-1 in favor of Obama. Well, you can't win the argument if you're not participating in it. And I think, you know, this study emphasizes this nagging doubt we've had since 2012, which was that for a large swaths of this country, for you know, African-American community, Hispanic community, and young people, the Republicans just aren't engaged in the debate. And if you want to win the votes there, you got to go out and do it.
I think you're right. I think that conversation needs to change. The tone needs to change. And we'll see how exactly that is implemented. But reaching out and actually having that conversation while explaining why conservative principles on these issues, economic, national security, and social, are the better way to go for individuals and for a society, I think is a healthier way to go than just ripping people who disagree with you and wondering why after you called them an idiot that they don't vote for you. So on to martini number two now. And speaking of economic doldrums, we've got a nice warning once again from Southern Europe about as southern as it gets, on Cyprus. We've talked a lot about the Greek debt crisis. Now you've got Cyprus. There's a run on the banks there after there's been an effort to tax bank deposits. And so everybody's trying to get their money out as quickly as possible. Rush earlier today called this Greece on steroids. So good luck to the folks in Cyprus. But Jim, as I recall, there was actually an attempt by some Democrats here to tax every single bank transaction. It didn't go anywhere. But the fact that such ideas are out there means that we might not be as far behind this curve as we think.
Yeah, a couple of things to bring people up to speed. I mean, Cyprus, for those who, being the old turkey hand that I am, can explain it to you. So Cyprus has not been on the American front page and the American consciousness since season 2 of 24 when Jack Bauer was trying to find the Cyprus recordings.
Right.
So it is this small island out in the Mediterranean. Most of it is – it's an independent country that's allied with Greece. There's a small chunk that the Turks would say – they would say they liberated. Other people would say they conquered, but it is considered Turkish Cyprus. This trouble is – that my Turkish friends would like me to emphasize is this trouble is occurring in Greek Cyprus. Basically, the bottom line is that Greek Cyprus banks are not safe anymore. That basically what we're seeing here is the effective failure of what would be in this country FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The idea that if you put in your money into the bank, that up to a certain level, that money is going to be there no matter how terribly the bank is mismanaged or what they do with the money. Well, turns out the Cypriot equivalent of FDIC doesn't have the money to cover that. So basically they're saying we can cover most of the money you put in the bank. Most of the money you put into our banks is safe. And when you tell that to the public, surprise, surprise, they run out to their ATMs and they take all their money out of the bank as quickly as they can. Now, the whole point of something like the FDIC is to prevent runs on the banks because, you know, for those of us who have seen It's a Wonderful Life and all these old movies that kind of explain that, you know, banks are largely run on confidence that it's safe there. And if everybody simultaneously thinks that their money isn't safe and they all try to take it out at once, that's when the bank doesn't have enough cash to cover all of the withdrawals. The banks in Cyprus will be closed until Thursday. That's reassuring, isn't it, Greg?
That's always reassuring.
You go to the all ATMs are down. You can't have any of your money for like another 4 days, and then maybe we'll let you have some of your money. Unsurprisingly, this has people in Cyprus panicked, and you know. If you're not a Cypriot, I'm really not sure why your money was in a Greek Cypriot bank. I think it was Megan McArdle who had a great point, who said, look, you could argue that this is a unique set of circumstances set up by one particular country's unique financial culture and bad decisions, etc. The problem is that Europe is chock full of unique one-time circumstances, it seems, and problems with its banking sector. And the bottom line is that if people don't feel safe about having their money in Cypriot banks, will they feel comfortable having their money in Greek banks? By the way, if you have your money in Greek banks, take it out now. What is it doing there? What do you think you're going to get there? You know. So then the question is, do they feel safe about Spanish and Portuguese banks? And the idea of, you know, dominoes one after another, everybody in Europe starts getting nervous about whether their banks are reliable. And increasingly, Europe and its, you know, entire economy kind of looks like a house of cards, and one part of the Jenga tower just fell, and now we just see how the rest of it, kind of the reverberations and ramifications are through the rest of the banking sector. You might say, oh, this is far away, it doesn't bother us, but you know, European financial collapse can't be good for us, Greg. I'm familiar enough with economics to know. You know, total upheaval in a big trading partner, that probably means bad news for us.
Yeah, I think that's a safe conclusion from that. And I've also heard Italy could be in that rotation as well, which is a much bigger economy, obviously, than Cyprus or Greece, and I think even Spain. So we'll see exactly how this plays out. But once again, the economic and debt situation in some of these countries, a great warning for the rest of us while we hopefully still have time to deal with it on our side. But on to martini number 3 now, and this one's interesting to say the least. Jim, I don't know if you've been watching the Bible series on the History Channel. I've been watching it with my wife, and we've enjoyed it to some extent. There's some inaccuracies that drive us a little crazy in there, to say the least. But one of the things that popped up in this last edition's episode on Sunday night was Jesus, after his baptism, going out into the wilderness and being tempted and obviously resisting that temptation from the devil. The devil, however, in his black hood and ashen face, my initial reaction, and apparently most of the rest of the world as well, looks a lot like President Obama, a much older President Obama, but still the similarity is almost impossible to miss. I'm guessing that Roma Downey and Mark Burnett, who put this all together, did not do that intentionally. But my guess is that the liberals will now accuse the Christian community of literally believing that Obama is the devil.
Literally demonizing him, it would seem. Look, first of all, you know, the picture's up on Drudge, so perhaps our words can't really do a judgment. The actor Mehdi Ouzani, who is apparently a Moroccan actor. Look, you know, people can decide for themselves whether or not he looks a lot like Obama. Greg, I'm just going to come out and say, look, let us be clear. President Obama is not the devil. I'm surprised I need to make that argument. For what it's worth, for example, you look throughout all the references to Satan, to the devil throughout history. The devil's very cost effective. Hell has not run a deficit in many, many years. It always has great access to resources. The financial efficiency of all – it must be all the money changers they have down there. I don't know. But anyway, bottom line being, President Obama, say whatever you want of him. He probably is better than the devil, right? Is that really too hard to say, you know, that he's probably not evil incarnate. He seems like a good dad and all that stuff. Now, if in future, no, obviously they're doing one segment per week of this. If the devil comes back in later episodes and is saying, let me be clear, you know, and things like that, little quirks like that, then maybe there is some sort of messaging going on there. But I think at this point, it's just an interesting coincidence. Worth noting, the guy is piercing eyes and all that kind of stuff. He's got the black cloak. It's very much your standard representation of evil, the Emperor from Star Wars and stuff like that. Just physically, it's rather interesting. If he does try to say to Jesus, well, we can always pay for this through the Buffett rule down the road, then you know that they're trying to send a very explicit political message in this. So perhaps this is, you know, perhaps evil like beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
I guess so. So you never know what's going to be the buzz on a Monday morning or any day here on the Three Martini Lunch. But Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.